Welcome to The Indigenous Approach, a podcast where we examine the role of the nation's premier partnered irregular warfare force across the competition continuum, from cooperation to conflict and everything in between.
All right, welcome to the Indigenous Approach podcast. We've got a great episode for you today, one that's really going to speak to your heart and soul. I'm Major Dan Lessard, the Public Affairs Officer for 1st Special Forces Command, and I'm here with Chaplain Brandon Moore, Lieutenant Colonel Type 1 each. He's our command chaplain. Sir, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And for the audience, having Dr. Lisa Miller on for the episode you're about to hear was Chaplain Moore's idea, and I think it was a great one. Sir, you've known Dr. Miller for a little while now. Could you introduce her to the audience?
Yeah, Dr. Lisa Miller has written two books, The Spiritual Child, and her most recent is The Awakened Brain. She's a professor of clinical psychology at the Teachers College in Columbia University. She's a founder and director of Spiritual Mind Body Institute. And most of all, she's a friend of the Army and the Chaplain Corps. I think you'll really enjoy this conversation.
Yeah, I certainly did enjoy it, sir. We brought on Dr. Miller to talk with you and Doc Riesberg about spiritual fitness. And what I really enjoyed, although we're talking about a subject like spirituality, which can be somewhat hard to maybe put your finger on, or folks are going to walk away from this podcast with some concrete tools that they can take some steps forward in their journey to spiritual fitness.
Yeah, she digs into what is the spiritual core and the science of spirituality. I think you'll enjoy it.
All right, Chaplain Moore, thanks for joining me today. Let's get to the show.
All right. Well, Dr. Miller, we're so glad to have you with us. Can you briefly explain the concepts you shared with our command?
Well, it's terrific to be with you, Chaplain Moore and Dr. Riesberg. It's really a joy and thrilled to be here at Fort Bragg. I actually returned to Fort Bragg because I was here about a year and a half ago. Since which time, I've been traveling the country together with the Chief of Chaplains, Chaplain Soljom. And we have been to, Fort Jackson and Fort Wainwright and Fort Leavenworth, all over the country. And coming back now full circle to Fort Bragg is a tremendous honor. We are sharing here today what really is the culmination of our year and a half of work together, which is the Spiritual Readiness Initiative. It started out as a pilot. It's now formed and iterated to really speak into the most pressing concerns and interests of the Army. And what we share is the science, the very strong peer-reviewed science of spirituality as foundational to our fitness and readiness, spirituality as essential in forming the character strengths and virtues, and spiritual readiness being really the most protective factor known to clinical or social science in preventing against what we now call the diseases of despair, addiction, depression, and even suicidality. So here today, we shared the science, we shared the vision of how across all bands of professional contribution, vertically integrated throughout the Army, the science of spirituality can be applied as a point of focus, an embedded or integrated skill, if you will, to help soldiers flourish, be healthy, and perform.
So when people think about spirituality or religion, they don't always think of the term that you use, spiritual core. What is the spiritual core?
Well, just as we have physical fitness for the physical core, so too we need spiritual fitness for the spiritual core to be whole and integrated people. If you take out the spiritual core, you have the weakness, you have a donut-sized hole in the center of the soldier. You really need, for whether you're talking about an entry-level soldier or a colonel or a commander, spirituality is the foundation on which good decision-making and resilience in tough times is based. So what do we mean by the spiritual core? Well, I think it's important to perhaps step back just a bit and frame this in terms of what is the difference between spirituality and religion. Right? So in the United States, about two-thirds of people in our country, citizens, say, I am spiritual and I am religious. My deep spiritual experience is held in the prayers, the tradition, the ceremony of my faith tradition. 30% of millennials, and fewer with each older generation, but more amongst Gen Z, say, I am spiritual, but I am not religious. For me, spirituality is felt in nature, in art, when I sit with my family, in music. Whether or not we happen to be religious, and no matter what denomination that may be, we all are spiritual beings. Spirituality is an innate, hardwired part of being human. In fact, the little baby on day one is born physical, emotional, cognitive, and spiritual. That every one of us is a naturally spiritual being. But that said, when we look through the lens of twin studies, we look at twins raised together, twins raised apart, factor out the commonality as a function of shared genes, shared environment. It turns out that spiritual capacity is one third innate, but it is two thirds environmentally formed, which means that your pastor, priest, imam, rabbi, parents, grandparents, the 10,000 conversations by your locker in high school, and now that you're here in the army, your commander, your fellow soldiers, your chaplain, all weigh in two thirds environmental to shape the spiritual core. That means that for a young adult entering the army at age 18, the formative process here is certainly one of learning of the head and knowing of the heart and building of the body, but it is also the formation of the soul.
One of the things our folks intuitively know from day one in their time in the army is working out. We're very physically oriented in the military, and especially so in this regiment. So for the newbie, the spiritual newbie that's trying to get in touch with that, how do I initiate a spiritual workout? And the analogy would be a little bit like our New Year's resolutions. It's hard to get in that gym and overcome that initial threshold. But once you do and you start working out, you start flexing those muscles, it becomes easier. What would you say, what's a good way to get into the spiritual gym and start working out that spiritual core?
What a great extension of the metaphor, because it really is true that it is indeed a question of practice, the choice to engage what I call our spiritual or awakened brain that allows us to see daily life in spiritual terms. And as you know, two-thirds environmentally formed means that one way we may have learned is through our family's faith tradition. And for people who are of a faith tradition, perhaps dusting off a rusty prayer that your grandma taught you. And it may feel awkward. You might even feel a little guilty right at first. But the more you say it, it very quickly comes to harmonize with your spiritual heart. So returning to what is yours, right, when it feels good and true, particularly if it was the gift of a grandparent or a parent, part of your family life. But for people who maybe don't feel connected to any tradition at all, a way in can be through learning to be very, very present in nature and being present to the miracles around us, looking at how life is regenerative and renews with each spring. Look at how, you know, the trees, they fall and a new one forms out of it. You know, there's something so rich and beautiful seen through nature. A walk in nature, 20 minutes actually, it's been shown through science, 20 minutes of a walk in nature elicits some of the same neural correlates as prayer. So there are people who say, I feel God in my cathedral, and there's some people who say, I feel God in the cathedral of nature, and they're both right. And they are both using the same neural correlates in their brain, because no matter how we visualize or what language we use or what symbols we might use to speak of the sacred transcendent relationship, whether it's God or Jesus or the universe or nature, Hashem, Allah, whatever our words are, we're using the same neuro seat of perception. It's the same spiritual brain. We are all spiritual people, and we all have a spiritual brain that we can choose to engage.
That's really powerful. What I love about that is it's low cost, right? That I don't even need to buy gym equipment. I can just go take a walk. I can find that transcendence. I can touch into that spirituality wherever I may find it. I just need to switch it on, really, and be willing to receive.
And it's yours. It's yours. You're right. It's not just for the most pious or the most meticulously moral. We are all spiritual beings, and we start where we are, and we can reopen our heart and connect to God or the higher power, whatever word is ours. But it is all of ours, and it's all of ours equally.
And it seems like there's a holistic nature. When you really start digging deeper, it's not a compartmentalized faith or fitness or other things, but we really realize that it's nested in humanity. There's an element of things are connected. And we talked about that with holistic health and other kinds of things where it's, if we even taking a walk in nature, there's a spiritual component, but there's a physical component. There's a mental component. So I think as we think broader, it's realizing we're humans holistically rather than compartmentalized.
Body, mind, and spirit. Mm-hmm. On day one, right? And also on day 4,000. Right. This is always who we are. But unfortunately, I think 40 years ago, in the very good attempt to be inclusive, we threw religion wholesale out of the public square. And the intention was good, that, you know, there should be no coercion or proselytizing. But what happened was we wiped the place clean and threw out the spiritual baby with the bathwater. And now, 40 years later, we have a spiritually non-conversant public square. There is a way to bring spirituality back that's inclusive, that knows each of us for just who we are, that is welcoming of spiritual diversity. We've come so far with racial and gender and orientation, you know, acceptance, inclusivity, diversity. Can we now bring that to spiritual diversity and really want to know each other in this deep core way? It's really, spirituality is the core, it's the hub of the wheel from what all other lines of moral and social development follow. You know, who are we really? And how should we treat each other really? Well, those are deeply spiritual questions. And I think the Army has been so innovative and so helpful to our larger country by focusing on fitness of the spiritual core. You know, by the Army getting upstream, building the spiritual core of what might otherwise be the downstream harmful behaviors, they're setting up a model for the rest of society. You know, the Army's challenges are the rest of our challenges as well across the United States. The Army has stepped up to do something about it as an institution. And in that sense, I think the spiritual readiness initiative is something that could be brought to higher education. It could be brought to businesses and training young employees. You've really, you know, you have hit the DNA of what this country really is about, which is we are a foundationally spiritual country and an inclusive country.
We've talked about spirituality and things, and maybe some of our listeners are like, yeah, of course, the chaplain's, talking about that. Could you explain? So, Dr. Miller, you've written The Spiritual Child and The Awakened Brain. You're not, your background isn't a motivational speaker about religion. What is the science of spirituality? How did you actually begin at Columbia University to kind of dig into this spirituality? And were people like, yeah, or opposed to it? How did that work?
Oh, thank you. So, Chaplain Moore, you're right. I am foundationally, for 25 years, a clinical scientist and a clinical psychologist. And I'll tell you, when I first started out in the late 90s, I was on an inpatient unit. And in The Awakened Brain, I talk some about this. I saw people in this urban inpatient psychiatric unit who had been in and out and in and out the revolving door of treatment 5 times, 10 times, sometimes 20 times. Very well-intentioned, very caring mental health providers. Well, we had yet to know what to do to truly help them get better, because when, you know, this is pre-digital era, right? Manila folders full of charts. When someone's chart was 10 inches high, the second chart was started. And you looked at, you know, literally in some cases, feet of chart, and you realized these people were not getting better. They were not getting better. And what was missing from the model? Well, I decided as a young intern at the time that the patient holds the truth. I was going to try to listen as hard as I can and figure out what did they need? What were they seeking? How were we yet to deliver as a mental health field a truly healing, transformative treatment? And as soon as the patients knew that there was interest, I mean, I'm telling you, they would pull me behind the door. Dr. Miller, will you come stand here with me? And what they had to tell me was something they didn't feel could be shared in the therapy office. They didn't feel it could be shared in the group treatment setting. It could only be shared in the corner behind the door. You know, Dr. Miller, I've got to tell you something. People say, you know, they all say I'm schizophrenic, but I want you to know something. When there is the world, little t, and the world, capital T. And when day in and day out in little t, the world, things get too painful, I go to capital T, the world, where Mother Mary is my mother and I am Jesus. This patient was aware that he was moving in and out of levels of reality to protect his pain. And he had never shared the fact that he was well aware that at the level of the spirit, transcendent, there was peace and love, but he was hopping into that metaphorical way of being as a way of getting out of daily lived pain. Or another woman, this was perhaps one of the most meaningful experiences in my early years as a psychotherapist, was in a very brief, probably 10-minute exchange with Miss Martin. She was not my patient, but she knew I'd be interested in what she had to say. So Miss Martin said, Dr. Miller, come here. Miss Martin was about to be sent after having had 11 visits to our inpatient unit upstate to a state hospital where she probably would never, from which she probably never returned. It wasn't a death sentence, but it was the end of her freedom. Dr. Miller, I'm going upstate tomorrow. Will you pray with me? And I said, well, yes, of course. She was asking her therapist to pray with her. So she said, great. And then she guided me again across the hall, into the kitchen, into the pantry, to the back of the pantry, to the pot and pan room where no one could see us. She only felt safe to engage with prayer, to engage with a therapist in prayer, hidden in the back of the pot and pan closet. So there together, she happened to be Catholic. I'm not Catholic, I'm Jewish. She took out her rosary and she started to pray. And at the end she said, dear God, please protect me when I go upstate. And please protect Dr. Miller. Very moving. I mean, I was going back to my husband, you know, and she said, Dr. Miller, will you pray? And I said, of course. And in the way that I knew how I prayed, and we went back and forth. This probably, you know, the whole thing probably was 10 minutes. It was the most powerful 10 minutes to this day of my journey as a therapist. Because when someone was in a place where they wanted to turn to God for guidance and protection and not be alone in doing that, you know, say, will you accompany me on this healing journey? It was such a privilege. What I took from that was that treatment without spiritual support had a donut-sized hole in the middle. You simply could not have a mental health field minus spirituality. And so from that day forward, that became my life's work, to try to use the language of science to integrate natural human spirituality into development, prevention, and treatment.
I think we see that same thing so many times with particularly our folks as we're working through post-traumatic stress. Or one of the things I'm really mindful of and concerned about right now, quite frankly, is the health of our force with the drawdown, Afghanistan, ending of a lot of our operations in CENTCOM. And we have people that have had brothers and sisters die in their arms in those conflicts. They've experienced tremendous personal loss and personal victory as well. It's been a source of pain, but also resilience for them. And so that's one of the things I love about your book. You talk about how some of these events, these negative events that happen in our life, can actually be formative in our spiritual strength and resilience. But I think now we stand at this crossroads where people had this great purpose of going back and fighting for what they had lost. And now that we're out of that war, there's almost a vacuum there. There's a hole there. And I think this is a great opportunity for folks to say, well, what really do I want to fill that hole with? What am I really seeking? What's my higher purpose? Because purpose for so long, for so many in our force, was based on, let's get back over there and deal some freedom out to the enemy. But now there's a pivot, there's a shift. So I think this really is, like we heard this morning from General Sondheim, from Chaplain Sondheim, this is an opportunity to an inflection point in our culture and in our force. Would you agree with that, Chaplain Moore?
Yeah, no, I think so. And even those that are listening on the podcast right now, you might be, whatever you're doing, you might go, you know what, I need help. So one of the things we realize in this conversation is just our command really wants to help. So we've got doctors, we've got chaplains, psychologists, others that are here to help and really reach out. So we're going to continue the conversation, but even just as a pause of saying, if you're listening and you're going, I'm having a hard time, then know that there are resources all across our command to ask, and we can refer and work together, because it's really not, you don't have to do it on your own. And even as our team, we don't do it on our own. So no, I think it's a great point, but you're right. As you talk about when you're dealing with those difficult times, it really is nesting all resources. And then you've talked before, Dr. Miller, about the protective forces of that spiritual core for harmful behaviors and other kinds of things. So we reach for some things, but how is the spiritual core or spiritual component in your research protective against some of the harmful behaviors such as suicide and other things?
Well, so as you might imagine, you being a chaplain, scientists don't define spirituality, but we can identify threads of lived spiritual life that are absolutely game-changing on the rest of our lives. And the two that time and time again are just blaringly clear, whether you're looking through an MRI study or an epidemiology study, no matter what the lens of science being used might be, is that when we have a close personal relationship to God, now God is my word, it could be to the universe, to the higher power, to Jesus, Hashem, Allah, but when we, whatever our faith tradition may be, or outside of faith tradition, have a close transcendent relationship, we have a way of moving through suffering that is entirely different. Right? I turn to God for guidance in times of difficulty. When I have a tough decision to make, I ask, what really does my higher power want me to do? That sense of not being at it alone, and not just believing, but perceiving the presence of God in our lives. Listening to God, listening in, with your mind's eye, with your open heart, and who shows up and says what to you when. That we are living, you know, we are walking together with God or our higher power through life. And when the worst of the worst happens, we're not shouldering it alone. Science says that when we can engage in a dialogue, a deep relationship with God in the most difficult moments, we come through. And not only that, we grow and we deepen in our relationship to God. We are, as Chaplain Soljom says, made bigger inside. What that looks like through the lens of science is that 75% of vets who meet criteria for PTSD at the same time report meaningful growth, post-traumatic spiritual growth. So suffering is indeed, it's an invitation to a deepening of our spiritual life. You know, the worst of the worst has happened. Dear God, why do you hand this to me now? What am I to see now? Where am I to look? And in a way that couldn't be predicted based on everything I've seen so far in my life, some new door opens, someone comes, there's a wisdom that comes. We can't do this ourselves, and we're not even built to do this ourselves. We are built to have a spiritual core, both to engage in life in a fuller and brighter way, but also in the hardest times. That is our strength. That is our staff. It is not a Band-Aid. It is not an excuse. It is not a crutch. It is a deep way of moving into life that is transformative and indeed how we are designed and built.
As you talk about that, what's the importance of community? So as we think about, there's religious community, there's the family origin and family community, our teams, our those we work with, friends. So oftentimes sometimes when we're in the lowest point, we feel alone. So there's a connection with God as we start to awaken or we start to look, but also what's the importance of those around us?
Well, so, you know, Chaplain Moore, I'm so glad you raised that point because science says equally, there are two threads, right? One is that we are in deep relationship to our higher power, and equally important is that it might be shared so that through our relationship to God, we know we're loved. We're held, we're guided, and equally that we might then show up for one another in such a way as to be loving, to be guiding, so that no one else is left behind, left alone. So when we are effectively, in the science, we call it relational spirituality. There's many ways we can be together. We can all show up at the park. We can all show up at the pub. We can all show up at the pool house. If we show up with intentions to be spiritually loving and present for one another in fellowship, or the squad could be this way too, right? When we show up for one another with the intention to be, if you will, ambassadors of love, of God, right? Then there's a way that we look to each other, unconditional acceptance. It doesn't matter if I was the one who saved the day or ruined the day, you look at me with love. And it doesn't matter if you're the strongest and the smartest or at the very bottom of the squad, I look at you with love. We love and know each other more than the sum of our parts. It doesn't matter who's the strongest or the weakest, the smartest or the most challenged, we love each other more. And that's a way of really seeing each other as spiritual beings. That's a way of forming fellowship with members of the squad that is so strong. It's brotherhood, it's sisterhood. Of course, we'll go to the mat for each other.
I love that. The relational aspect of our makeup, right? I think we see that in our friends or in our groups. Some of us have seen that in our family, some don't, right? We have different positive and negative relationships probably in our life and formational. Oftentimes people say there's two things don't discuss in religion and politics, right? And we're not going to talk about politics, but we are kind of talking about religion or spirituality. But what I think's interesting, I've heard you explain before, is you called it spiritual multilingualism. And oftentimes we think that we only will talk faith or spirituality to those people who believe the same things we do. And then those who have different beliefs, like someone who's Jewish or Muslim or believes something different, then we either have to argue or fight or just be quiet. But I think this term, spiritual multilingualism, and realizing the importance of friendships, maybe is a bridge that could even be more protective for us and open up understanding to encourage others in their faith.
We know that there is one common human spiritual heart. And if we look through MRIs, we see that there is one common human spiritual brain. I call it the awakened brain. But when we look through an MRI, whether, again, I'm Hindu, Catholic, Jewish, Christian, spiritual, but not religious, in a transcendent relationship with the higher power, we all use the same, really the neurodocking station, the same loop in our brain. So one third innate means that, okay, there is a vast, rich, beautiful diversity of religious traditions and different symbols, and each tradition uses a different language. But can we use our deep, common human spiritual heart to know what is being said by our friend, by the fellow soldier in our squad, when they speak through their own tradition? And the answer is yes. The answer is yes, because every faith tradition has a way of understanding the birth of a child, the loss of a grandparent, the renewal of spring. Everybody in our heart can feel what is being said. So I'll give you an example. We do this in my class at Columbia. One person will say, when my grandma, she tattooed me, she linked me to all my ancestors through time. And the next person will say, I know what you mean, because my grandma, she loved me. I mean, she adored me, and she taught me to pray. So now when I think of God, it's kind of God and my grandma all rolled up into one. And the next will say, I get that, because when my back's against the wall, I can feel my grandma's with me, and sometimes I even hear her. And someone says, yeah, I get that. I don't know about all this language, guys, but for me, I know that energy can never be destroyed. So of course we live on in some way. They're deeply connected. These young people are all deeply connected, but they're sharing their spiritual reality through a rich range of languages and symbols and traditions. They are spiritually multilingual. It's a discussion, and it's one where I want to know you. I want to know you in the deepest way. I want to be your friend. I want to be your sister, your brother. Spiritual multilingualism is more than being polite and nodding. It is a form of deep bonding through the rich diversity and differences of different traditions.
Yeah. I think as we look, even in our formations, the uniqueness of a team, it's stronger because of the different skill sets and the diversity of what they know. And when the unique skill sets come together, it becomes stronger. So there's times when we don't have to agree on everything, but we can bond through commonality. And I know I've heard you talk about, often we, and Doc probably could too, that all of us are about 90% the same. And it's the 10% that's different, how we grew up, genetics, other kinds of things that often we focus on to divide us, but instead we could focus on the things that are common and be appreciative of those things that are different, to learn and grow, and we become richer as we begin to connect and learn from others.
So, and Chaplain, that is precisely how we are built. We have in each of our brains a parietal region, and the parietal, when activated, puts in and out hard boundaries, which means that I can, in one moment, in a spiritual state of awareness, maybe after prayer or after meditation, at once, very same time, see that, okay, there you are in your zipped up bio body suit. And here I am in my zipped up bio body suit. And you're in North Carolina and you're in Texas and you're in California, different GPS coordinates. So we're wonderfully diverse and we're different and we have different names and cultures. And at the very same time, we are 90%+ the same. There's one common human family, one family of life. And the ability to toggle between appreciating each other's magnificent diversity and I want to know you as you tell me your story. How do I have any sense at all of what you're saying? Well, there's a common human heart, right? Loving and connecting and appreciating each other, empathizing is with the common heart. So we are distinct. We are one. To my students, I say we are a point and we are a wave. We're all different and unique, but we're part of one magnificent sea of life. That conversation tends to be missing right now from the center field culture. We have a splintered identity issue. But, you know, we need to acknowledge that we are both different and one. Because if we're only different, there's no common ground. It's just a power grab. And if we're only one, then we ignore the important injustices that go along with being different. But if we're both different, unique, and one, then we have this beautiful way of coming to know each other for each other's different journeys in life. That's a winning perspective, and it's how we're hardwired when we use our natural spiritual capacity, when we engage the awakened brain. We are hardwired in a spiritual state to see each other's oneness. Look right in and feel the illumination of the soul.
That's really good. One of the things I love about that, Dr. Miller, is you mentioned the public forum and what we've lost by retreating from our true spiritual natures. But what strikes me now is there's almost a climate of fear. There's a climate of fear of offending, a fear of getting too close to the truth almost. And when you think about true spirituality, there's no fear in that. And I love your definition in your first book, The Spiritual Child, where spirituality is, it's not religion, right? It's not. And so I think many of our listeners, this is important for them to understand. We're not talking about going to the mosque, the synagogue, or church necessarily. That could be part of it. We're not talking about things that necessarily are dogmatic or can be very divisive, because I realize that's off-putting to a lot of our listeners. Yeah, a lot of bad things have been done in the history of the world in the name of religion. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about that deep part of your brain that we can prove on functional MRI, just like I can prove a traumatic brain injury on a functional MRI. You can prove spirituality, and your research shows that. I think that is so powerful for people to understand. This is not religious dogma. This is part of your biology. It's a part of your innate toolkit of being a human being. And so it's a little bit like fight or flight, appetite, hunger, basic human needs. You've got a basic human toolkit for spirituality, and all you need to do is pick up those tools, and we all share them. So where's the fear coming from? How do we overcome that? How do we encourage people to pick up their spiritual tools, even if they're a newbie, even if they're a novice, and just start tinkering and embrace their spirituality? And then I think through that, we'll realize the fear goes away. We're all spiritual. It's our birthright, as you say, you know, in the spiritual child. How do we encourage people to embrace that instead of being so fearful of offending others and getting into this divisiveness of, well, that's not my religion, that's yours, and we're against you. No, how do we center on that common foundation?
It really seems like understanding that we're in this together. I mean, we realize that I've got your back. We're on the same team, the squad. But when you realize it's not about a debate, we could debate if that's what we decided to do. But really, understanding spirituality is a conversation and trying to understand, when I understand what's deepest and most important to you, then you also would want to know what's deep and important to me. And we sometimes, what do we say, especially as guys? What do you do? So that's like first level. Then the next might be, well, where are you from? Or what's your family? How many kids do you have? Or are you married or not? But another level that's even deeper to get to know someone would be asking, what's your faith background? Or could you tell us something important? What's important to you? A purpose, something deeper. And again, I think we build those relationships. And I think we do need to, as a team, as
others, how do we build bridges rather than barriers? And life becomes just better that way. I think we've talked about that, but it's like you're not alone anymore. Now you've got a friend that doesn't have to agree with everything. We look at faith sometimes as it's like you have to agree, but think about, so those who are listening, think about your friends, your team, your spouse. When you ask, where do you want to go eat? I don't know. Where do you want to go? Or there's an argument, right? We can't even agree on where we want to go eat for dinner, let alone have to agree on all that we understand about spirituality and things. But it could be part of the friendship. It's a dance rather than a fight is maybe another way of looking at it.
You know, I think right now, the country is really divided, right? And as you're suggesting, if instead of, you know, looking at someone and saying, I wonder if you wear a red shirt or a blue shirt to your political debates, right? If instead I were to say to you, can you tell me the time your kid was in the ER? And I'll tell you the time my kid was in the ER. Connect as parents. Connect at the deepest core of who we really are. You know, can you tell me the teacher that you had in, you know, K through six that changed your life, who believed in you? I'll tell you mine. You know, these are these deep human times of incredible love that we all experience. And if we can think of ourselves as parents on the sideline at the soccer game, I don't know who's a Democrat and who's a Republican. I don't care, right? But I really love them, you know, and we love each other. And I think that the Army, really more than any institution I've ever seen, is made out of love. I mean, this is a brotherhood and a sisterhood. I think you're about 14 steps ahead of the center of our society. And the fact that you're taking this on is going to help us all. But I think one of the many things you have to share is that you do build brotherhood and sisterhood. You have love. And it doesn't matter where I came from or what I look like. You love me, right? And I see that here, that, you know, people succeed here based on merit and people are cared for because they're loving and loyal to each other. I mean, to me, Army eyes are like X-ray eyes and you see right through to the soul.
One of the things I reflect on, great story, As I was going through selection here at Fort Bragg, we had a guy get injured, and the rest of the team came around him, realizing that he wouldn't make it through selection with his injury, but had grown to love this individual just in a short period of time on a 12-person or 15-person size element because of so much difficulty. And so everybody had really tapped into their faith traditions. There was, you know, people were getting together and offering to pray together in the morning, and again, it didn't matter what your faith tradition was. It was just like, we need something additional to make it through this. And this individual gets injured. And one of the most impressive things I've seen was two or three other individuals said, hey, give me some weight out of your rucksack. I'll carry that for you. Fully knowing they're exhausted too, and this could jeopardize their chances at successfully completing the event or passing the selection. And this is a silly example, right? Because it's a training event. But the same thing happened day in and day out in combat operations, where you'd see people sacrificial love, this deep-seated value that there is something more important than myself. And so, Dr. Miller, I can't agree with you more when I say we are well postured to lead this country, particularly in this regiment that has lost blood, sweat, and tears, brothers and sisters in harm's way over the last 20 years. We are experts in nothing else, if not in our own spirituality, in understanding sacrificial love. And I think that's a great starting place to tap into and activate that striatum, activate those structures in our brain that allow us to be aware and spiritually awakened, and then help others build that relationship.
Sacrificial love is the one thing our country needs right now. I mean, that is the answer to ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. I think, you know, the Army culture is exactly the culture that the rest of the country can emulate. And the more you speak openly and the more you share how you think of one another and how you lead and how you work, the more people around you will learn.
That's great. And I think that's one of the other things that I'm so mindful of. We have people that transition out, and many veterans and folks that are listening right now might be in that position. And there's a deep emptiness with that loss of that team, that squad, that type of love and transcendent relationship. I really believe it is a transcendent relationship in the trenches. When those angry hornets are snapping above your head, those rounds are coming in, or you've just put that tourniquet on your buddy to save their life, there's no atheism there, right? You're very clearly tied into the universe in a very metaphysical way. You are hyper aware of what's going on around you, the feelings you have for those on your left and right. So coming down off of that, coming out of that mountain and back to society and trying to integrate in a way where things can feel superficial and you lack that deep transcendent connection you had with your team in combat, I think you've just given us one of the tools. And that is, it's continue to serve, continue to love deeply as you did in combat with your teammates. Find an outlet, find a way to continue to activate that circuitry and awaken your spiritual self, just like you did in combat when you were hyper aware, sacrificially loving those on your left and right.
And by living the way that's so true to soldiers, you ignite that possibility in civilians. Right now, I mean, we have to yell stat, right? There is an urgent emergency and it's in the center of our culture. It's a complete untangling of civil life, right? And civic life, I think basically what happened with the pandemic, civic life shut down and people watched politics on TV. And then they watched politics on TV some more, so much so that the sort of, you know, wavelength, the bandwidth of politics in the national consciousness is really much larger than it needs to be. We can give politics back to the politicians and fill out civic life back to our faith communities, back to our softball and soccer games, back to our service work, Habitat for Humanity. I think the depoliticization of society will do us a lot of good, get back to living. The Army is good at that. I have made, in the past 2 years, so many wonderful friends and colleagues in the Army, and I couldn't tell you for one second who's a Republican, who's a Democrat. I have absolutely no idea, right? Because the relationships are so strong and the work at hand is our work. And I think that civic life can renew itself primarily through what you're describing, sacrificial love, spiritual relationships, transcendent awareness that we are all God's children or all emanations of the higher power. This is a very American way of thinking, what you're describing. Is it right down into the DNA, right, of our Constitution? Well, and do you know, Jefferson's first draft read, "We hold these truths to be sacred, that all men are created equal and independent," right? So what we call self-evident is the sort of truth value, the obvious truth of the sanctity, the sacredness of one another being free.
You've talked about awakened brain and things, but could you describe for us the difference between awakened brain and achieving brain?
Thank you. It's a very important point. I think that our whole education system, and in fact, in the air and water of our culture, is that starting from when we're very young, we are raised to achieve. And achieving is great. You know, everyone here is doing good work because we all worked hard and achieved, and all of our, you know, people joining us are working hard. Achieving is important, but the achieving brain is one based on strategy, planning, tactics. It's incredibly important. It's how a mission is prepared, you know, but it does not square with the totality of life. Planning and strategizing only gets us so far. And of course, soldiers know this more than most people, that there are plenty of surprises.
And Murphy gets a vote, right? Murphy shows up.
So what, you know, how much is there control in life? I'd say there's a thin layer of icing of control on a big pound cake of dynamism and flux. And when strategizing and tactics don't square with the moment, we need to move out of what I'm calling the achieving brain into the awakened brain. And the awakened brain is really, if you will, our deep natural capacity for spiritual awareness. And in these moments, we move, if you look at the brain, from an attentional system that's very narrow and bowling alley, the dorsal, to a bottom-up ventral attention network, where suddenly far more information is available, situational awareness. And many people even say the right answer, the way out, the way up, pops. So in a state of prayer, in a state of reflection, a state of spiritual engagement, we are guided. The awakened brain, also our birthright, all of ours, allows us to feel that life holds us. God walks with us. Whether you say Hashem or Jesus, whatever your word is, the spirit in life holds us. We don't fall through to existential annihilation. So how do we know that? Well, the bonding network comes up online in the state of spiritual awareness. And just as we were held as children in our parents' arms, we know that life holds us. And then finally, as we'd started to discuss, the parietal that puts in and out hard boundaries lets us know that as painful and dire as this moment may feel, and as isolated and lonely, and that feeling can be very, very real, I am actually never alone. God is always with us. And actually, as sisters and brothers, we are never alone. So that is our birthright, to be able to perceive through our awakened brain, to choose to engage and build the muscle of the awakened brain. And if we do, particularly in times of difficulty, particularly in times of suffering, we can develop a strength in our spiritual core that girds us against subsequent depression. You know, the statement, build your ark before it rains. We are prepared that much more for next time, the bigger flood.
So you may be thinking, you're listening to this conversation and you may be thinking, oh, that's great. Yeah, I do care about faith or spirituality. I care about those on my team. But what do we do practically? How do I begin to build? One of the things is I've been kind of brainstorming with my team is even something as simple as, what are you trying to accomplish? So if you were wanting to get better at the knee tucks, the strength coach could explain all these things that you could do to get better at knee tucks. Now, what about if we just wanted to be joyful, right? I remember coming home or had a conversation with my wife, and my wife said, hey, I just want you to know your son, he came up and talked to me, and you know it's bad when your wife says your son, right? And she said, he asked, why is Dad so angry? And it's like, I'm not angry. Or, oh yeah, it's because he didn't do what I told him to do or whatever. But I think there's times in our lives when we have to slow down enough, listen, that awaken, and go, okay, what would it be? It's more important than the leg tuck might be to bring more joy into my life. So what would be something I could do to bring joy? So we need to awaken to even some practical things. And so what would it do to bring joy? Could I come home with a different attitude? Is there something I could do by going in, instead of looking at what my son didn't do, maybe the achieving versus awakening is beginning to say, hey, let's go out and get some ice cream, you know? And tell me about the Minecraft game or whatever the thing is that you're doing. And then that builds the relationship and probably, again, would bring more joy to my life. So it's, are there specific things we could do to then have the output of joy? Because it just doesn't happen. Just like we're not going to get better at leg tucks by doing nothing.
Yeah, thanks, Chaplain. One of the questions I'd ask Dr. Miller is, it's a common interview question, and I think it's a great one for first-line leaders to just ask their people, what makes you tick? What gets you up in the morning? That's a fairly benign, easy way to introduce that deeper concept of where someone's at spiritually. Like, do they have that sense of calling or purpose? Does giving back energize them? So what makes you tick? I don't know. What do you think, Dr.?
And where does your strength come from?
That's good.
And I think when a leader makes it clear that it's okay, we do talk about this here, you know, maybe in the first person saying, for me, you know, my ultimate connection is my connection to God. And before I make a big decision, I take a moment of deep receptive prayer and I ask God, what do you want me to do here? That's transparency. It's not proselytizing. It's not saying that you need to use the word God or Jesus or Hashem or universe. My word is God. And in fact, by saying, soldier, where does your strength come? Soldier, what does your own spiritual core say? Soldier, tell me about your own spiritual heart. We're giving a soldier-centered view, right, onto spiritual life. It's the opposite of being coercive or proselytizing. It's honoring the natural spirituality in each soldier as his or her ultimate source of resilient strength and fitness and perseverance, not to mention ethics, right? So a soldier-centered view, in schools we call it a student-centered view, allows us to be pluralistic, inclusive, and constitutional, right? Because it's no one's religion. It's your own natural spirituality. Let me hear your own voice.
So that's great for the leader, the junior leader that's listening, or even the senior leader. Those people you interact with day to day, as Sergeant Major of the Army would say, this is my squad, right? That's your squad. Those are the people you care about that you have a charge for, to care for. And so I think to your point about joy, I'm reminded of that analogy, when's a golden retriever happiest? When it's retrieving, right? So if you know your people and you know what gives them strength and you can provide that, that's going to fulfill them. That's part of your sharing and giving and transcending with them. They're going to achieve that fulfillment, that deeper sense of purpose and calling, and a lot of joy in that.
Build the ark before it rains as well. If today was tough, really tough, and we're all sitting down at the end of the day, you know, soldier, what did your spiritual core say about today? And what about you? If we can hear each other out, then basically what we are doing here together, the eight of us, after a tough day, is we are building up a spiritual response to disappointment, a spiritual response to loss or failure, which is a stance that will be needed very much so when the stakes are higher. Why do we have post-traumatic spiritual growth more readily available to us? Because we built up a spiritual response to suffering. And we see in the brain that the regions of the brain that might have been thin due to repeated suffering, depressogenic ways of thinking, loss, actually those same regions get thick and strong and are neuroprotective when we marshal a spiritual response. The parietal, precuneus, occipital regions of reflection, orientation are strong and there for us to be more resilient when little by little, almost like an inoculation, we are prepared for big challenges, losses, and even trauma.
Dr. Miller, that's where I've loved your books, because it's helped give me a framework for understanding this, because I've never seen this in my 22 years in the Army like I have in this last 6 months, is we have people that, very resilient, have done amazing things over the last 20 years, pulled their families through 9 combat deployments, all this other stuff, and they're kind of falling apart now. Why? Right. Well, I know why. It's that transcendent experience of war that was holding them together. It was this greater purpose, a higher calling, right? Perceived through this great purpose of, you know, love and sacrificial love, like we talked about. But now the question is, okay, well, what now? I hear a lot of that. That's the core question they're asking. Well, who am I now? Because everything I fought for and sacrificed for now seems to be falling apart, right? Like that, when you watch those last days of the Taliban running through the country, and so many have given so much for that, that's an existential crisis for some people, right? We fought hard, lots of blood and treasure, and now that's all for nothing. But it's not, right? And that's the hope of this framework and understanding. No, what you tapped into in that combat, in that conflict, was that was the beginnings of awakening your spiritual brain through that sacrificial love. Is that accurate? Is that
accurate? And our society needs you desperately.
Okay.
To bring that deep transcendent love into the center right now of civic life, whether it's through your job or through your family or through your faith community or for a community service, Habitat for Humanity, the local part, whatever you do or where you want to be, our society desperately needs that strong army caliber, transcendent love, sacrificial love to bring us together as ordinary citizens, to bring school communities together, to bring your kids' soccer team and basketball team, to bring your workplace together. People are at each other's, and there's no reason for that. You know, to bring that unitive, committed sense of transcendent love right back home into your own town. They need you. They really need you. And maybe in that way, coming home can be coming home carrying the torch, the light of what real brotherhood and sisterhood looks like, and setting that ablaze in your own home community.
When you talk about awaken, and maybe that goes along with this, that would help those that are listening, could you maybe tell part of the story and explain the castle and the wave, the folk? Because I think
that's a great analogy.
Because I think as we think about our service and things, it's we're focused on
the castle,
the sandcastle, but yet there's a looking up from that would take us to another level.
Beautiful. So for having loved fellow soldiers in the way that I see the Army truly holds. You know, the Army family is real. that is real love. You know, can we graciously invite soldiers to come home and show us and teach us that caliber of love, right? And with that, you know, the world turns and nothing is permanent. And so there's two ways of looking at life. One is that we add up the balance sheet and the score sheet and we say, did it matter when we add up the score sheet? That's sort of the utilitarian view. Let's add up the pluses, the minuses. Did it last? Did it last? Well, nothing lasts, right? The other way of approaching life is in and of itself in each moment. Who was I? How did I treat you? Did I serve God? Who are we in an ultimate sense? And if I add up my life as a score sheet, how many things did I do right? How many things did I do wrong? Did they really matter? Did the world get better or worse because of me? That additive game, that I put that over on the side of achieving awareness. The whole thing is an illusion because the world turns. But if I look through the lens of who in this moment in and of itself was I? Did I carry love? Did I carry loyalty? Did I carry strength? Who in and of itself in this moment were you and who were we to each other? That's eternal, right? One little moment, one speck of love, one instant of love is eternal, its power, its presence. So we can look at our service in and of itself as rippling through eternity.
And maybe I'm interpreting more with the castle and the wave, but I think it's a nice way to end maybe this podcast is in the book. It was help me understand, but the way I would look at it is this idea where I think it was a friend of yours or a client, and all of a sudden they had this aha where they realized their whole life they were focused on the sandcastle. But once the sandcastle was gone, they looked up and they realized that the ocean and the sun and the waves and everything all around. And I think there's times the listeners or each of us, we go, are we so focused on something that's small or even something that's temporal that if that's taken away, we can begin to open up our eyes or our mind to see something larger. It doesn't make what we've done in this world or what we've done in our jobs insignificant. It's just lifting our heads up enough to see that there's more. This has been a delightful conversation. So glad to have you, Dr. Miller. Thank you for joining us.
Very moving conversation. It's really an honor and a joy to be here.
This has been The Indigenous Approach. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Follow us on social media. And if you have suggestions for topics or guests, send us a message. Thank you for listening.